Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for coming back. This is Renee at Renee's Heart to Heart. I have a very interesting story to share with everybody today. I have a granddaughter who has given birth four times, and all four times were C-sections, cesareans. And each time she's received an epidural. Now, a lot of you ladies out there are very, very familiar with what an epidural is. An epidural is medicine that's released into your spine that helps numb the lower part of your body, supposedly, and if everything is done properly. Now, first, I want to share a story. I've been there for the birth of several of my grandchildren and a couple of my nieces and nephews. And it's an amazing, amazing thing to see happen, the birth of a child. And in most all of them, the girls received an epidural. And first they give them something to calm them down in the beginning of the labor, and they rest for a while. And I've always sat and watched the monitor. In the old days, you told the doctor how bad the pains were. He came in, put his hand on your belly for a little while, and felt the constriction in your stomach. And then he took a look, and if the measurement was a specific number, if you were dilated a certain amount, then you were ready to get the show on the road, so to speak. Well, now the granddaughter that I'm talking about, all of her babies were delivered, as I said, by cesarean. Cesarean, obviously, you need a little bit more pain control because an incision is made and the baby is removed from the uterus. So her oldest child is almost 11, and she has a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, and one that will be 1 in October. So about, 10 days ago, she's always been prone, since the birth of Miley, who's 5, to excruciating migraines. And, of course, she's been to the doctor. The doctor gives her a painkiller or has her take ibuprofen and tells her to relax. And no easy feed, by the way, when you have that many children. And relax and until the headache subsides. In a lot of cases, migraines, if you've never had one, lucky you, but if you have had one, you can relate to the fact that they are not just painful. They can make you physically ill, sick to your stomach, throwing up ill. And a lot of times, light and loud noises are excruciating. So very recently, Melissa started experiencing major migraine. The kids called me. I said, put some lavender on her temples, maybe even a little bit on her chest, and cold pack on the back of her neck and have her lay in a very dark, cool room and relax. The kid never gets a break. The baby was born with bilateral club feet. I've talked about him on the show before. And a few months ago, we almost lost him to MRSA-infected spinal meningitis. So he is very spoiled now. Melissa seldom puts him down. She carries him around all day. And at this point in time, he wears full casts from the tops of his thighs to the end of his feet to correct the club feet. So he's very heavy. So we're thinking about all these things and chalking up, you know, the fact that she's been prone to the migraines, which is probably due to stress, and the constant care of this adorable little boy. And we're kind of thinking, you know, little rest, she'll be better. Well, 2 days went by, and she got so sick, couldn't keep even swallow water down. My daughter-in-law took her to the emergency room. And they examined her, said yes, she was having an acute migraine, did some other tests, did some blood tests, and then decided that they wanted to do a spinal tap. Now, if you've never had a spinal tap or been involved in that, I've never had a spinal tap. I've never had an epidural. So I, for the sake of being totally honest, I don't know what it feels like. But, of course, I do. As I said, I've been there for everyone else's. And I've already noted some very strange results from epidurals, which I will mention later in the show. But when they did the spinal tap, they were trying to rule out, I'm sure, spinal meningitis. Some strains of spinal meningitis are incredibly contagious, and the baby was kept in quarantine for quite a while when he got so sick. And when we went in the room, we had to wear masks. We had to wear all the stuff to keep things sanitary. But Melissa was there all the time. Day in and day out, she slept there. So, of course, it crossed my mind as well. So they did the spinal tap. The spinal tap came out clear, but she got worse. So they kind of sedated her, and they gave her an elixir that has a lot of caffeine in it. Now, caffeine is supposed to be a cure-all for a migraine, because the caffeine apparently loosens up the constrictions in the blood vessels that are tightening up and causing part of the migraine. And she really didn't get any better for a second day. So they did some more tests and found out that she had a leak. A leak that she has more than likely had for 5 years. A puncture wound from the needle, from the epidural, for the birth of Miley, the 5-year-old, that was little by little leaking some spinal fluid and taking up some space in her head. And then they believe or assume or think or whatever they do, that when they did the spinal tap to check her for spinal meningitis, they went right to exactly the same place and opened it even further. So more was leaking into her head. Well, I don't know about you, but this sounds horrific to me. Horrific. And I don't understand how something like this could happen. And and if it's happened before, why on earth it's ever happened again? But it did. And what they do is very, very interesting. They actually make a blood clot over the injection with your own blood so that it seals it. Now, I question that, probably because of my lack of education in regard to it. But a blood clot, I thought, could be dangerous. I thought a blood clot could add to your problems, especially if it breaks loose and gets into your bloodstream. However, they make it sound as though it works just like a patch, and that's what they call it in some of the articles I read, a blood patch. So I want to read you some stuff And if anybody has any input, please call me in at 337-152-35. Oh, sorry, I'm giving you my phone number instead of yours. 347-989-0352. And share your story with me. But I'd like to share with all of you. I found several sites, but this one I found to be the most informative. The other thing I want to add, these kind of epidurals are done for people with sciatica, with chronic lower back pain. I have a brother and sister who have received many of these injections for back pain. I've always been against them. Wasn't sure why. I just don't like the fact that you're putting something in with something that we're born with naturally and that we made, and there's just a million different reasons that it just goes against my grain. By the way, I had 4 children, and about the most I ever had was like a Novocaine so that I could be cut during the birth of one of my kids. My last child weighed 10 pounds and was 24 inches long and was being born feet first. So, but everything else I had naturally. And I always felt great after the birth of my children. I had energy, I could walk, nothing hurt. It was great. So that's why I've always felt that that was the best way. However, I hated when I was with my own kids and they were giving birth to grandchildren and they'd be in pain. So I was grateful so that they could get some help with that. So here's the article that I found. In childbirth class or hospital classes, you may learn a lot about epidural anesthesia. They'll probably tell you all about the risks and the benefits. You will probably learn how and when it can be administered. You might even see the procedure or talk to an anesthesiologist about the procedure. But chances are the information you receive in class will end when the epidural is placed or shortly thereafter. Many moms have questions about the epidural procedure and its effects after birth. Here are some of the answers to those questions. When will the epidural catheter be removed? Typically, the epidural catheter will be removed within an hour or two after the birth of your baby, if you had a vaginal birth. This is typically not painful, but may feel strange as the epidural catheter is pulled from your back. Many moms report the removal of all the tape to be more painful than the removal of the epidural catheter. If you gave birth via cesarean section or surgery, occasionally the epidural catheter will stay in for a few more hours to help provide you with pain relief after the surgery. Your anesthesiologist can also place medications like Duramorph into the epidural catheter to help provide pain relief after the epidural catheter is removed. This medication will not cause numbing like the typical epidural medications will cause. If you are having a tubal ligation, your tubes tied after you give birth, the epidural will stay in place until after your surgery. The epidural catheter may be removed by the anesthesiologist or a nurse. How long will I be numb from the epidural? Many moms report being able to wiggle their toes and a slow return to sensation within hours of having the epidural medications discontinued. Part of what you will need to factor into this answer will be what type of epidural you had, continuous or bolus. If you had the continuous flow epidural, once it's turned off, you can usually have full sensation back within 6 hours of birth. A bolus type of epidural will depend on the last dose of medication that was given. Some women experience tingling, shaking, numbness, and other sensations in their legs during this period or after. It can be perfectly normal, but you need to report it to your nurse. And then there's also the bladder catheter. Your bladder catheter can be removed once you can actually bear weight on your legs. If you have problems urinating after birth, you may have to have the catheter placed back into your bladder to help you until you can successfully urinate on your own consistently. It's really important that your bladder remain empty. Some women have more trouble with this because of the epidural medications and the numbing, or because of damage done to the bladder with the bladder catheter. This is usually very temporary. Anything else to expect? Of course. You can also expect to feel very sore once the medications wear off. I encourage you to begin taking medications that your doctor or midwife has prescribed as soon as you can, preferably before the epidural medications wear off. With an epidural, you are more likely to have had an episiotomy, forceps, vacuum, or a cesarean. These all intensify the normal pain after a birth. Start with the non-narcotics and see if they help your pain level, and reserve the big guns for later. You may find out your lower body is stiff and sore. This is frequently because your muscles are stiff from remaining in the same position for a long time during your labor. This happens because you usually are unaware of the position you are in because your legs and lower body are numb from the medication. Simple stretching and time will generally be all that this is needed to help change this. You may also feel a need extra expulsive efforts due to your inability to feel. I think that means you pass gas. Get up and walk as soon as you can to help you feel more in control of your body. This can really help change your physical and emotional feelings about your body. This also speeds up recovery. Now you understand the procedure. And I want to say, in regard to this is the perfect time for me to mention this. Two of the births that I was there for, one is a sister-in-law, one is my daughter, and when they received their epidural, instead of the epidural going to the lower half of their body where they need the pain relief, it went up and made them cuckoo. I mean, cuckoo. They experienced drunk, under the influence of a mind-altering pharmaceutical. Both of them rambled, slurred speech, and still were in tremendous pain. But in a couple different cases, not able to articulate what was going on. So when I requested the anesthesiologist to come back and see what was going on, I was informed, are you ready for this, that this isn't a science, Grandma. I said, you're sticking needles in people I care about's back, and it's not a science? I think you and I need to talk. They informed me that sometimes they have to change the way the patient is sitting to guarantee that the numbing agent will go down instead of going up. So the result of this story was they both had more done. So their side effects after they gave birth were almost, like they had been really drugged heavily. My daughter couldn't even help. I had to watch so that I could tell her when the baby's head was crowning, because she couldn't feel anything when he did the second injection. So, you know, I understand pain tolerance. Some of us have it, some of us don't. Some of us have more than others, some of us have less than others. It's one of those kind of things that's a real personal thing. But I don't know about you, but I don't ever want somebody sticking a needle in my spine. And I didn't want it before I read about what my granddaughter just went through. So take into consideration and really educate yourselves about what they're going to do, how it's going to affect you, what the long-term effects are going to be. Don't just blindly follow because everybody else has done it before you. This is another one that of those things that we talk about that is very personal, and we're all so different. You have to really make sure this is the way for you to go. And if it isn't, speak up. It's your body. Now, here's what they say about the headaches. The spinal headache can occur as a result of a procedure such as a spinal tap, lumbar puncture, or epidural block, such as that performed during a woman's labor and delivery. In these procedures, a needle is placed within the fluid-filled space surrounding the spinal cord. A needle is placed within the fluid-filled space surrounding the spinal cord. That's in and of itself is incredibly scary for me. This creates a passage for the spinal fluid to leak out, changing the fluid pressure around the brain and the spinal cord. If enough of the fluid leaks out, a spinal headache may develop. Because the design of spinal needles has been improved, spinal headaches after a spinal tap or administration of spinal anesthesia are rare. When epidural anesthetics are placed with a larger needle than that used for spinal anesthetics, however, the likelihood of a headache is higher if the epidural needle should inadvertently pass through the dura mater covering the spinal cord. A spinal headache may occur up to 5 days after the procedure is performed. The spinal headache often is described as a headache like no other. Spinal headaches are much more severe when the person is in an upright position. They improve when the person lies down. The first course of treatment for spinal headaches involves supplying adequate hydration to try to increase cerebral spinal fluid pressure. Sometimes intravenous fluids are given. The other times, the person is advised to drink a beverage high in caffeine. Strict bed rest for 24 to 48 hours may be recommended. In addition, if a person develops a spinal headache following a procedure, the anesthesiologist can create, now this is the important part, can create a blood patch with the person's blood to seal the leak. To administer a blood patch, the anesthesiologist inserts a needle into the same space that they went into before or right next to it, the area in which the anesthetic was injected. The doctor then takes a small amount of blood from the patient and injects it into the epidural space. The blood clots and seals the hole that caused the leak. So, very, very scary for me. Very, very scary. And I question the procedural physician, anesthesiologist. You know that if something happens to your spine, you can never walk again. You can be a quadriplegic. You can be put totally out of movable commission. I mean, I have a friend whose kid dove into the ocean many, many years ago and hit a sandbar and jarred the very top of his head, which caused a jolt down the back of his neck, from his brainstem down the back of his neck into his cervical spine, into his lower lumbar. He lost the use of both arms. His legs came back, but his arms never came back. Our spine is like as important as our brain. It's all connected. I think it's very, very, very scary to be messing with this part. I mean, years ago, a woman was just told how to breathe and go through the pain. Many, many years ago, before this had been, I shudder to use this word, refined, my mom had what they called back then a saddle block. And she was in such intense pain after the baby was born that they had to put her on like a board and keep her flat and sandbag her head so that she couldn't move her own head until everything started flowing the way it was supposed to. Now I wonder if they actually made a leak and it sealed itself. I don't know. I mean, my mother died at a very young age, but it didn't have anything to do with that. But it does make me wonder now that I know this. I find this to be incredibly scary, incredibly scary. And at the end of the day, I'm also thinking, you know, that this is a lot more dangerous than they inform these young mothers about. They make it sound like it's done every day, which apparently it is. Millions, thousands, whatever the number is of women have had it done, and nothing happens to them. Well, again, let's remember how different we all are. This could be very, very dangerous. I see that Donna, who is a nurse and talks on the show every now and then, she just came in and saw what we were talking about. But she's, she's not called in. I wish she would, because she, as a nurse, she may even have more information to offer. But it just floors me that many different things can happen to you. So now, my granddaughter, I picked her up from the hospital yesterday, and she is home. She cannot lift the baby, which is going to be a problem. She can sit and hold the baby, but she can't lift him. She will have to be very careful for I don't know how long, and rest a lot, sleep a lot, as much as she can, and lay down in a just completely flat position whenever she can. Now, when somebody tells you, when a doctor tells you that you have to take these precautions, isn't that scary to you? Doesn't that make you wonder, well, what if I don't have time to do that? Or you know, what if I can't? What if the baby's fussy? What if the kids are fussy? What if I'm the only one home? What if I have to make something to eat for everybody? To me, it's like not very good follow-through care, for starters. And apparently, if this has been happening very slowly for 5 years, how do we know now, and how does she know, that if she just gets a headache, does that mean we have to assume she's sprung a leak? Does that mean somebody's got to check? We also believe, and I think I mentioned this, that the original leak was exacerbated by the spinal tap to check her for spinal meningitis. So if this is something that they know happens, I don't know. It scares me, I guess. And I'm not trying to find fault in anybody. I'm just questioning the thought process. If you know all this stuff, why isn't all this stuff being taken into account before you do certain things, especially things that could change somebody's life or even end somebody's life? But in my book, changing it so drastically as a quadriplegic or something like that is much worse than the alternative. So this scares me, and I will keep an eye on this, and I will continue to research this until I have more answers in regard to this. Now, the other thing that I kind of wanted to bring up today is we talked yesterday about addictions. We talked about places for young people that don't want to go and possibly won't stay, what the alternative is. Obviously, there's only two that are really out there that are dependable. One is jail, which gives you no counseling, no additional help for your issues. And the other one is a mental institution. And a mental institution is sometimes the answer. I'm not going to turn a blind eye to that, because I do believe sometimes if things have gone too far awry, a mental institution may be the perfect answer, at least for the very beginning of someone's recovery. But there's nothing else. There's nothing else, no other place that will keep somebody against their will to receive something that may, in the long run, save their life. So it is what it is, but it scares me. So we talked about that yesterday, and I also mentioned Monday that I wanted to talk again about bullying in the workplace. And I'm going to open up that topic this morning. And I mentioned Monday something about one of my grandchildren. And I want to say that the work world is not what it used to be. It really isn't. When I was a young woman, if you showed up for work every day and did a job to the best of your ability, your job was pretty secure. In Ithaca, where we moved, I had a brother who was born there, so I lived there at a very young age, and then we moved back there when I was 17. And a lot of the jobs supplied in Ithaca, New York, come from factories and Cornell University and Ithaca College. Job security is amazing there, or always was. If you started working at National Cash Register, which is now no longer there, Ithaca Gun, which is no longer there, that was almost the only way you lost your job, unless you didn't do your job, unless you didn't go to work every day. Today, and Cornell University and Ithaca College has great job security, great benefits. And sometimes many generations of families work at the same place, sometimes even do the same job. But today it's a lot different. It's a lot different. There's a lot more people, possibly not as many jobs, even though that doesn't even seem possible, but I do believe a lot of jobs have been deleted. I believe a lot of places run on electronics. The doctor that I talked to this week for another, actually for my husband, he said, you know, when they came up with the computer system so that a doctor can talk into a computer, Dragon, I think most of them are called Dragons, this innovation, you eliminated thousands of jobs. Because every doctor I know, at the end of any given day, sent paperwork in, and it was all copied and transcribed by people. He said, that doesn't happen anymore. So that deleted lots and lots of jobs. Well, and now they're talking about robots doing some of the surgeries. Again, that will take out not just, I don't know that it will take out a doctor, because somebody's got to, you know, keep an eye on the robot. But what about all the other technicians and nurses and nursing assistants that were in the room at that point in time? So one of the vocations that I thought would always be safe, which is, you know, healthcare, is also, you know, there's some suffering there in regard to the amount of jobs that are available to be filled. So what's happening is it's become very dog-eat-dog, literally. It's become point your fingers at somebody else so nobody looks at you, and it's rampant. It's rampant. I have a granddaughter-in-law who's had several jobs. She's very innovative. She's gone out. She got her security license. She did anything anybody told her so that she could have some job security. And that particular arena as well has become very, very crowded. Working in a big condo or any of those kind of things, you have security guards all over, people that walk the grounds, people that man the desk, all of that kind of stuff. But the minute it looks like everybody isn't got enough to do, everybody starts, you know, I saw so-and-so, she took a long break, she was talking on her cell phone, he was doing this, he was doing that. It's become unbelievable. And then, of course, in my eyes, the poor guy that has to listen to all this crap, he gives up, she gives up, and says, you know, the one that gets complained about the most without even any research or anything usually loses their job. It's become awful, awful. You cannot just go into work every day, do your job to the best of your ability, and feel secure. Ironic that I'm talking about a security job and you can't feel secure. I just realized that I said that. That is ironic. But even in the hospital, all the times that I've been in the hospital here recently, every nurse I've talked to tells me about all of the other jobs that she has to do besides taking care of the patient. And if somebody, that's like waitresses and side work, right? You don't just wait on the guests. You have all the stuff to fill and clean and prep and all that kind of stuff that people don't even see that side of it. So I think there's something amiss. But to start at the beginning to try to fix this has something to do with how we treat each other. And being bullied by coworkers is, first of all, difficult to deal with, but also very demeaning. Because in some cases, I meet people that actually have started to believe that they're not doing a good job. They believe in all the crap that somebody, well, I don't do that. Maybe I should do that. I never was told I had to do that, but maybe I should be doing that. You need to stand your own ground. If you feel in your heart that you're doing what you should be doing, then that's all you should have to worry about. You're there every day. You are in your uniform, or you're in your whatever attire is requested of you. You clock in, you don't clock in, you sign in, whatever the deal is, you do a good job. And you know in your own heart that you're doing a good job. Your job should be safe. Your job should not be jeopardized by someone else, especially another coworker. So let's analyze a little bit. I have very strong feelings. As a manager for many, many, many years, at the Institute, I was the general manager. All the other managers answered to me. The employees answered to me. I had an open door policy, which meant I didn't care if you were the dishwasher, swept the greenhouse. I didn't care where you worked. My door was always open if there was something going on that you felt somebody else had to know about. So I felt like I kept the bullying a little bit under control. And if I realized there was a problem between two staff members, I would bring them in together and talk it through. And sometimes during the conversation, I would pick up on exactly what was wrong. And I would see where the kink in the road was for these two people. And sometimes I could fix it and sometimes I couldn't. Sometimes I would just make sure these two people didn't have to depend on each other, because that's the worst. If you're trying to depend on somebody as a partner or a coworker and you can't, it makes your job even more difficult. So I have great feelings about being harassed, being ganged up on by other staff members. Why? Because it happened to me. At the end of my tenure at the Institute, a lot of changes took place. And perhaps, in hindsight, I was stubborn. I can be incredibly stubborn. And some of the things that were changing, I didn't like. I didn't appreciate. And I felt very involved in the way things were, and it was hard to let go of some of those things. So let me say that if you are being harassed or you feel that you're being harassed, you are being bullied by coworkers, maybe they're on your level, maybe they're above you. In some cases, they're even below you and think if they defame you a little bit, they'll get your job. I get that. But maybe you need to look and see what you're doing. And those are just words of experience. Maybe you need to check out your behavior, your reactions, and the way you're doing things. And maybe somebody has a right to feel like they need to protect themselves against you. In assessing everything that happens, and when you really, really, really examine a situation about compatibility and camaraderie and support from other people, the first person, no matter what you're talking about, that you got to examine, and the only person you can do anything about is still you. So I hate it. I hate the fact that people can't go to work and do their job and have a certain amount of peace and tranquility in their job. I hate that people who are in the service industry can't give the service to the guests because they're too busy covering their back. I hate all that. I really do. And I find it small-minded. I find it tiring. It makes me feel like there's so many other things that could be being done with your time. So if that's going on with you, assess what's going on. If you have a human resource director, I would put everything in writing. A wise man once told me that, and I didn't think I had to. And now I'm sorry I didn't. Put things in writing. Today we have mass email for businesses. Everybody can see everything you're doing. And sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes that keeps you in a place of light in more ways than one. If you shine the light on yourself, the perspective of your light is always going to be better, brighter, and more honest than someone else's. So do it to yourself. Shine the light on yourself and say, this is what I'm doing, this is why I'm doing it, and this is the outcome of what I'm doing. And people, no matter who they are, can't really fight your honesty. If that makes sense to you. They can't really hurt you by turning your own honesty against you. They can't. So it's up to you to change the scenario. If you think somebody's singling you out and you've gone to someone, it did you no good, you didn't get the kind of results that you imagined you would, then you need to start. And again, if you're not in a position where you do the emails, if it's not office work, if it's something well, like my granddaughter, a security job where nobody is on the computer. It's just he say, she say. Of course, that's the worst kind of place. But a log, I mean, way back in the day, I had waitresses log in and log out of a book that talked about little issues that might have happened. Or managers would, you know, that managed a shift. In a lot of restaurants, you have shift managers. There's a general manager, an assistant manager, and then there's shift managers. I had the shift managers write a log so that everybody knew what everybody was doing. It's important. I never thought it was when I was young. I thought, I know what I'm doing. Nobody else cares what I'm doing. But at the end of the day, if somebody's put in a corner, they care about what everybody else is doing. And if they can point their finger at you and get all the attention on you, you could have problems. If you are being bullied at work, check it out. Find out, you know, where it's generating from. And if you can't go to a human resource director and you can't go to your immediate supervisor, or maybe you are the supervisor, then you need to log everything. You need to write everything that's going on so that you've got something to look back on later if it ever comes to. I mean, today people are being sued in workplaces. I once was sued for prejudice, and I am probably the least prejudiced person you would ever meet. I had a couple that I hired, which I didn't usually like to do unless I knew them personally, but I did, and I had to let them go because every time I turned around, they were together instead of at their assigned positions. And I warned them 3 times, and then I had to let them go. They went to unemployment and said that I had abused them and I was a racist and all kinds of things like that. So I had backup. I had documentation of everything that took place in their files, in my notes, everything. And obviously it wasn't true, so it all worked out fine. But what if I hadn't had all that stuff? What if I hadn't had the documentation and the different conversations that I had with other people about what was going on and the days, dates and days and hours and places where I could talk about? So it is important, and I feel for you if you're being bullied at work a lot. I feel very strongly about taking care of your own business before you put your nose in someone else's. And if we did do a better job with our own business, how many times have I said this? A million. Everything would be better if we all just took care of our own stuff. It's pretty scary out there how many people are involved. We've had several shows about the whistleblowers, Edward Snowden and some of the past whistleblowers, and talked about what everybody knows and what everybody doesn't know. And I always take the stand that, you know, I don't care who listens to my phone conversations. I'm not doing anything wrong. But one thing that's wrong with that statement, and after I said it, I thought to myself, you need to maybe rethink that, because the truth of the matter is you don't really know how somebody is going to assess the things that you do. And you don't know what kind of a spin can be put on it. So documentation of what you did, why you did it, where you did it, and when you did it is really, really a safeguard for you. It keeps you in a much, much safer place and keeps you aware of everything that's going on in your workplace as well. It's shocking how many times you can think you'll remember something that took place. And I just looked at my log recently from the Institute. I had several notebooks of logs. And I'd forgotten so many different incidents that happened to me or happened to others at the Institute. It was fun to read through all of it and remember some of the things that we overcame and some of the things we all did together. It was a wonderful place to work. I loved it, and I loved being able to feel like I was helping people. So if you're working someplace where somebody's not treating you the way you should be treated, you need to address it. But first you need to make sure that you are walking your walk and doing what you know you're supposed to be doing. And then address it and keep a log so that you always have something to back it up with. But also let me say this. If you're working someplace that you don't love, you don't care, and you're being abused there, leave. Don't leave until you find another job, but find another job and leave. Life is too short. You don't need to be miserable for 75% of it. And let's face it, if you're a grown-up and you're working, 50% of your life is consumed by your work. Your work day, the trickle-down effect from work, all of it. 50, maybe higher than that, percent of your time is spent worrying, doing, or being at work. So try to be happy with it. And if you were bullied in school and you just got so you ignored it, my advice to you is everything that you ignore doesn't go away, ever, for some reason. What it does is it sets up a little bit of housekeeping someplace in a corner of your brain, and it never, ever leaves you. So when something like that pops up again, the familiarity is there, and so are all the feelings and the emotions. Get rid of some of that stuff. It doesn't serve you in any way, shape, or form. And it's not good for you to keep in a place like that. It just isn't. So I think that if you are struggling with things like that, I think it's up to you to clean it up. Now, I also want to mention, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to mention that I am blown away by all the incidents in regard to, they're taking my son to the hospital again. He can't breathe again. I'm going to probably sign off a little bit early. But if you are, made me lose my train of thought. If you are involved with anybody that has a child and drives their car and leaves their baby in the back seat of the car and has a tendency to be, you know, a lot of people are, you know, unfocused for whatever reasons, not for any outside influences, they're just not focused. I think if you have a big family and there's a baby in the family, everybody should talk about what has been happening with these horrible child deaths and illnesses that are being caused. It is an incredibly hot summer here in Florida. I sat in my car yesterday waiting for my granddaughter to come out of the hospital. And I don't leave it running because I think that's such a waste. So I just had the windows down and I sat there and I thought, my God, imagine if the windows were closed. I wouldn't have lasted 15 minutes. So it made me think about all these things that have been happening with these babies. I feel very strongly about this, and I think talk, as usual, is often the answer. So please, if you have a family and there's babies, everybody talk to your family and make sure that they're aware. Maybe put maybe set your phone so that when you park your car, when you get to your destination, a message comes on your phone, blinking and buzzing and beeping and tooting, and says, "Don't forget the baby in the back seat." I mean, I wouldn't have needed that, but obviously some people do. I cannot believe that all of these incidents this year were done with intent. I can't go there. So I apologize. I'm going to sign off 4 minutes early and find out what's going on with my son. Boy, I'm having a quite a ride in the year 2014. Thank God I know how to hang on. So God bless everybody, and have a great day. I will be back tomorrow, and we'll sum up the few shows we did have this week and talk a little bit about everything. God bless everybody. Have a great one. Bye-bye.